Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 331. Well, welcome back to another episode of Theology Simply Profound. My name is Bob Turillo. I serve as pastor of Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Countryside, Illinois. And with me, as always, is my co-host, Rob McKenzie. Rob serves as an elder here at Westminster as well. Hey, Rob, how's it going today?
It's good. It's good. The monsoon is over.
The monsoon? Oh, you thought that was a monsoon, man. Wow.
Well, it was, well, maybe.
Was it down there? Was it that bad down there?
It was just raining. It was just raining a lot.
Yes, yes. It was watering our garden and doing everything very nice. That was good. What's that?
It was making the accursed grass grow
faster.
Yeah.
And then it got sunshinier out and everything, you know, which means it's going to grow even faster. Yes, I know.
Yeah.
I know indeed the feeling you are feeling. So I think I need to tell everybody apologies for
no, it's about time.
Yes. For last episode at the end, which, you know, I kind of like say all sorts of different things. Sometimes I say things that I don't even know. But I recommended everyone go to iTunes, and you questioned me rightly.
Rightly.
You were like, I don't think that's used anymore. And I was like, yeah, of course it is. But I think it's now Apple Podcasts. Right. Or something of that nature. So all I want to do is people go out there and give us 5-star reviews. That's what I want. And comments, because I'd really like to know how, you know, what you guys think about the podcast. It's been a while since there's been any written comments or written reviews. It'd be fun to get a sense, see how we're still doing, you know, like a 5-year checkup or something like that. 5-year. If you've written one already, come back, write another one. Let us know if we're still doing the same thing, right?
Just use a different name.
Yeah, you can use a different name. That's right.
Copy and paste if it was good.
And so anyway, yeah, I'd be curious to see if y'all are out there, what you think. So Apple Podcasts, I guess, is where those reviews go now. iTunes is a part of the dinosaur age of technology. So yeah, that just shows you where I'm at these days.
Yeah, iTunes is right next to MySpace.
So. Yes. Well, we're back to Daniel today, aren't we?
We are. Wow, we're going to get there fast.
I know. Wow. I mean, I looked around and I was like, I don't have anything else to say.
I did think with this that we should, we needed extra audio sound effects or something just because of the dream. That we're in, like, we're in a dream sequence.
Oh, should I add some,
dream sequence sounds?
Maybe from like an old movie.
Yeah.
Chimes. Yeah. All right. Well, if you guys hear, I don't know if this will happen, but if you hear chimes, then I actually know what I'm doing. Let me find my phone and see if I can just throw some chimes in here.
Somewhere. No. Maybe I withdraw. I withdraw the suggestion. I didn't think it was going to happen.
Yeah, well, hey, once, maybe twice, we did the crickets.
Early on.
If you remember that episode, you are a faithful listener, and thank you.
He was so excited to get to add crickets.
Yes. I mean, there was absolute dead silence for like, I don't know, a few seconds in our podcast that one time.
Did you do that once during the dispensational series?
I think so. I think we did it during that.
Because I had said something and you threw that in because it just destroyed your brain.
Yes. That was. You know, I could have had more of those with the red heifer stuff.
That's true. Yeah, we had somebody at church that was listening that.
Yes.
Jed was saying that he's learned all about red heifers.
Yes, yeah, and you know,
how helpful it was.
It just makes me hungry, you know. It was my daughter's graduation the other day, and I, you know, put on the smoker. I wish it was red meat, but I haven't done red meat on the smoker yet. So if you have favorite recipes, send them my way. But so I just did pork shoulder, but it just. Anytime you talked about the red heifers, it just makes me want to have some wonderful big piece of red meat grilled or, you know, put on a smoker and just really enjoy cooking, enjoying a nice beer alongside that. And yeah, so, oh, well. No red heifer talk. You make me too hungry.
But we've talked the last few weeks about kind of leading up to this dream. Nebuchadnezzar had this dream, and nobody could tell him what it was. Finally, Daniel, God reveals the dream to Daniel, and he goes to the king, and now he's going to actually tell the king what the dream is and what the interpretation is. And it's interesting. I think that in this passage, it's easy to get distracted by the image itself, by the statue, and even some of the interpretation, what it's referring to. But there's so much going on here when it comes to the providence of God, the sovereignty of God, the rule of man, how Christians can understand how we live in society, how we should look to the Lord, how we should pray. I think that all that is going on. And so I was listening to several sermons by semi-Arminians on this passage, and it was really interesting, their interpretation. We'll get into that in a little bit. But why don't you open us up? Why don't you read just 31 to 35, and let's get the dream itself before us.
All righty. So like we said earlier, we're Daniel chapter 2, and this is 2:31 to 35. This is Daniel speaking to the king. He says, "You saw, O king, and behold, a great image. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold altogether were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." So that's Daniel 2, 31 through 35.
You know, there's no wonder that King Nebuchadnezzar kind of was freaked out about this. He'd had other dreams. He'd talked to his interpreters, told them the dream, they interpreted it. I'm sure there was in the back of his mind, he might have thought before this, I wonder if they told me that, if I demanded they tell me the dream, they could do it, because it's easy to interpret something. You know, you hear what it is, you give an interpretation.
Yeah.
Who knows if it's right or not? But he hadn't asked that before. But this dream is different. And Nebuchadnezzar, he himself, have you ever had a dream that you felt was real? That it didn't feel like a dream. To you, it felt completely real. I've had those dreams before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You've told me you have very vivid dreams, you said. Yeah. And
Even to the point where I've been in a dream that was so real that by the time I realized in the dream that it was a dream, I would try to wake myself up. And sometimes I couldn't even do it. I think this is the kind of experience that Nebuchadnezzar was having, where he was in this dream. It was vivid. And of course, this is a vision dream. This is given to him by God as, so it's much more than a dream. But he's standing in this plain with this giant statue in front of him. And, you know, the valley itself is, or the plain that he's standing in, it's bright. So the statue is giving off this brightness. He must have been terrified. And, you know, as we know, there's the gold, the silver, the bronze, then the clay and the the iron and the clay, and this building piece, this stone, like a building block for a building or a palace or a temple. Mm-hmm. He watches it being cut, not by human hands, but it is being cut out of the mountain by God, and it hits the statue at its feet, and the statue breaks apart, and it becomes, you know, I mean, this is still what? Gold and silver and bronze and stone, but it becomes brittle like chaff. Mm-hmm. Like, and then it blows away. And all that's left is that stone that becomes a mountain. And then it fills the whole earth. And, you know, Nebuchadnezzar demands to know, he's so desperate to know the meaning of this dream vision that that's when he asks for his interpreters to actually tell him the dream, because he didn't want to chance it that they were just going to tell him what he wanted to hear or just make up something. He needed to know. He was desperate for it. And it's interesting, you know, when we talk about stones being cut to build a kingdom, I mean, that's what they did. There's a whole archaeological discipline or within the archaeology of studying ancient quarries and how far did this quarry, and like Stonehenge, one of the big mm-hmm. revelations of Stonehenge and one of the studies of Stonehenge is where were these stones quarried? And some of them were from really far away. Others were from near, but they can find the actual quarries. So this was something that was associated with building projects, the cutting of stone from a quarry and bringing. I mean, we still do that today, but we don't think about that when we. Usually, it's steel that's in a factory and it's molded,
sure,
and it's brought there, things like that. So we don't think about the quarries much. But actually, I live really close to a giant quarry, and it's just, I think it's limestone that they quarry. And I drive, there's a bridge that goes over it. I drive over that often throughout the week. And it's an amazing sight, actually.
It's huge. I've never seen the bottom of it.
Into that. I have, but only because I was flying in.
Ah, okay. You flew
Bella
over.
And I both. We were flying from mm-hmm. Florida, and we looked out the window, and we could see the bottom of the quarry. And that was really cool.
Yeah. You know, that's kind of interesting, Rob, because you also lived near a quarry when you were up by the city.
That's true. Different quarry. I grew up by that quarry.
That's right. Yeah. The one. Yeah. Anyway, that's an aside. Now, if you know the geography of our landscape here, you'll know where Rob lives.
So, I mean, this can be a little bit of a conjecture because it doesn't actually say that in the text, but I think that Nebuchadnezzar knew that this was from a god. Obviously, he wouldn't say, oh, this is from the God. He believed in many gods, and I think that he saw this as something that was, again, more than a dream, a vision, but also from the gods. I think that's where he was being drawn towards.
Well, I mean, if that's the case, right? I mean, so we've talked about over the past couple of weeks, a couple of episodes, we've talked about how there was something different about this because of the way in which Nebuchadnezzar is adamant that the wise men of his empire would speak of the dream itself. Mm-hmm. You tell me the dream. So he recognizes that there's something unique about this one because of the way it terrifies him, because of the way it as we conjectured, kept him up at night, you know, whatever the case might be in reality, but something was different because of the way in which he is now asking the rulers, not so much asking, telling the rulers, not rulers, sorry, wrong word, the wise men, the magicians, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, telling them that they need to describe the dream to him, reveal the dream to him. So there's something different about this one. We can conjecture because of that. I think that's not too far out of the lane. And he might have also, as you said, you know, that might suggest to him that it's different by way of its source. It's not just a dream, you know, that, well, he wouldn't have these comments about, you know, our subconscious or anything like that. He wouldn't have any understanding in that regard.
Right.
He's thinking of it in a different way. And it might also come from the content of it. Now, we've, you know, gone over it just very briefly, but, and I read it, but you've referenced, you know, the image there, it's mighty of exceeding brightness. So there's something that stood before the king, that illuminated the area. It was just, I mean, when I think of this, when I look at it immediately, what do we think of? What's bright and terrifying that typically we see in the scriptures, you know, when an angel comes in the presence of the angel, something divine or something of another world. Now, again, it's conjecture, right? The image mighty and of exceeding brightness stood before you, the king, right? And its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver. There's just like something coming out of heaven with just this, a glory about it, but frightening glory and so on and so forth. Its chest of and arms of silver, middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. So you get this description. So it's bright and big, but why would it be that way if it's got clay and iron? Those things aren't in particularly exceedingly bright. So there's something else going on here. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand. That gives the impression, I think you referenced this just in passing, that God was the one doing the cutting, right? It doesn't say it, but that's, I think, something we can, you know, talk about, and you can see, I think, that something invisible is cutting away, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, and they dashed them, broke those into pieces, and then the iron and the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces. So that one stone cut by no human hand destroys the rest of the statue, this thing that was bright with an appearance that was frightening. It broke it like chaff. Summer threshing floor. Wind carried them away, not a trace to be found. Now, if we take that literally, there would be no remnants of these empires, but I don't think that's right. The point of it, right? The point of it is their power is gone and is no more.
Right.
Their empire, kingdom is gone. And that stone, which was cut by no human hand, grew so great that it filled the whole earth. So, I mean, I think it's just good to reiterate, because it's something that we're relatively familiar with. I don't know how many people reread and over Daniel, but it's a familiar story. And so, but it's good to slow down when you read these things. You just get a sense of the cadence of it and get a sense of what is being set before us, even before you go to the interpretation. You know, we have, this is one of those wonderful moments in scripture where we don't have to wonder about what something means, because God has given us the interpretation of that something, that dream. So, you know, we can learn from that and we can see how God is working here. So the interpretation, I think, might be what's next.
Yeah, it's when Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar that he is the head, that he is the golden head. I think he was pretty pleased with that. He's the highest. He's the head. He's the most precious material. But there's something very interesting, and I think very important, that we're told is that Nebuchadnezzar Babylon here is said that he rules the whole world, all the people, including the people, the animals, birds. He rules over all. And it's interesting that we're told that he rules over the whole world. Now, at this time, they would have even, Babylon would have been aware of people groups outside of Babylon that were not under the Babylonian flag, if they had a flag. Why is this? Is this true then? I mean, obviously the Bible's saying it, God is saying it, that, you know, Daniel's saying this to Nebuchadnezzar as a spokesman of God. What do we do with something like this that Nebuchadnezzar said to rule over the whole world? Because people outside of Christianity would look at something like this and say, well, wait a minute, there were people in the Americas, or there were people in China and Australia, there were tribal people, and obviously we can't take this as being a true statement. What do we do with
that? We can take it as a true statement from their point of view, in the sense that it's, you know, like, you know, when we talk about the history of the known world, right? When we talk a lot about, sometimes we use that language of European history before the discovery of the Americas. You know, they would talk about, you know, this person was a ruler over the whole world, and you know, Rome did similar things. You know, the whole world in their minds, all that mattered was Rome. They knew that there was stuff outside of the Roman Empire. They were the barbarians. They were outside of it, but all that mattered was their area, and that's what they called the whole world. So I think we can get bogged down sometimes with technicalities, the way that we think of statements of, like, the whole world, or ruler of the whole world. And we would think, okay, well, obviously not, because, you know, the whole world would include Antarctica, for goodness, right? And there's no one ruling it right now, as far as we know. But it's, so I think we find ourselves, get ourselves into unnecessary conundrums that only a modern mind would be thinking about in that way. And I don't want to say foolishly, but
I think that's a really good point, the idea of the modern mind.
It is. I mean, that. It's the same way, I think, when we think about, you know, chronologies in the Bible. It's also, I'm sorry, not chronologies, genealogies is what I was thinking about. Genealogies in the Bible, but also the way in which we think about, like, the Gospels and the telling of Jesus' history. Mm-hmm. It's different than a modern biography, right? It's just written differently. It has a different purpose. It's not to give a detailed account of every piece of personal history of Jesus Christ. So same way goes for Acts or any other of the histories, Exodus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. They're all selective for a purpose, a theological purpose, a historical purpose, and for a purpose that God has set for the people of God. And that includes, you know, the modern mind has become very analytical and scientific with regard to its expectations for certain genre, right? And so we think genre should, like, a biography should include this, and if it doesn't, well, it's not, you know. And so, the way that we think about the whole world is different, I think, than the way in which an empire or an emperor or king would say, I rule the whole world, right? Yeah. I am the strongest king in all the world. He's being, you know, overly dramatic and exaggerative because that's what he had to do.
Yeah, I think part of this comes into play with the idea of literal and literalistic. They were looking at the civilized known world, and to them it was, this is the whole world. And if you want to get literalistic about it, there are people groups outside of your kingdom. What about them? Well, they don't matter, because they're not part of the civilized known world. They just don't matter.
Yeah. And so, as far as they're concerned, now we know that there actually were civilized regions out there, you know, especially, you know, moving eastward and southeastward into India and China. And I mean, highly advanced, wonderfully, like, beautiful architecture and systems set up in their civilizations. But the Babylonians didn't care.
Right.
Neither did the Persians after that, you know? And so you describe yourself with, you know, just abundance and as though you are the best thing that you are. So anyway,
Yeah. But it is interesting because we're not just talking about how Babylon or Nebuchadnezzar would have looked at their own kingdom as ruling the whole world. This is God through Daniel saying, you are the head of gold and you rule over the world. This isn't just coming from a secular kingdom. God is saying you rule over the world. But again, it goes back to this literal versus literalistic, where God took Israel and placed Israel in a certain land, and God focused his plan and how he would communicate through his word and through his people in a very certain specific region. And so he's speaking from that region. And while, of course, people in other lands that aren't part of this, like you mentioned, the other empires, it's not that they don't have the same kind of value as a human as Babylonian does, but this is where God is working. This is where God is going to bring about the Messiah, is through this region of this very large region of the world. And so we need to look at what God is saying about these kingdoms in comparison with that fifth kingdom that's going to come. That's what's important here, is what is God saying about the kingdoms that are now in comparison to the kingdom that he will bring. And that's the important thing, and that's what we should that's what we should be focusing on as well. But still, Nebuchadnezzar, he's told that he is the head of gold. He's very happy about that. We'll talk about that in the next chapter when about how happy he is that he is the head of gold.
So we've been talking about this, and let's get this in front of us. So we're into the interpretation now, of course, because that's where we are. And it's at verse 38 of chapter 2 that you've been referencing. But let's back up to verse 37, because here in the interpretation, Daniel says, referring to the king, King Nebuchadnezzar, "You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power and the might and the glory, and into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all, you are the head of gold." So you see this exuberant, almost, and this majestic description of King Nebuchadnezzar, and the way in which, you know, Daniel is given an interpretation, and it is a divinely inspired interpretation that Daniel is providing for him. And so you see that God has given Nebuchadnezzar this place, right? We know God raises kings up and he brings them down. Even in the same book, God will lower Nebuchadnezzar greatly. He will humble him, but he also lifts them up. And so whatever power they have, it's a power or that dwells, that has been provided through the God of heaven and earth. But he's described as having the power, might, glory, that wherever they dwell, children of man, beasts of the field. So you see, and this is why we were referring to the whole world and all that kind of stuff. And people say, well, if you look at this passage, it looks like he's being described as someone who rules over the entirety of the known or of the earth itself. And you don't have to go there when you say that. It is a vast and expansive kingdom, but it's not the end all and be all, right? It is not all of the earth, all of the world, and everything. It is limited, even though it sounds like it is overall. Right.
The language that's used is that he is the, it is said he's the king of kings.
Yeah. I mean, that's language that we reserve for Jesus himself.
Right.
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 And so he is being exalted to a position of great height.
And he said all, all the, you rule over all people, you rule over all animals, all the birds.
Yeah, making you rule over them all. You are the head of gold, right? So there is a purposeful elevation here of Nebuchadnezzar's position for this. You know, he's the one that God has put in this place, and he is the one that will be used in a particular way for God's people. To a certain extent, it's, you know, he was the instrument that destroyed the nation of Israel and Judah, or Judah, I should say, the southern kingdom. Mm-hmm. He did that. See, he far exceeded what he should have done, right? What he was supposed to do. It's kind of the way the Assyrians were put out. They far exceeded their mandate in thrashing the Israelites. So he raises them up, and they usually do something wrong in the process of doing the thing that God has asked or had called them to do in judgment. But now he's kind of like their protector at the same time by having them in Babylon and staying in the city. I mean, a person like Daniel, those that are faithful are being protected. And then under Cyrus, they will go back. I mean, this is judgment. We understand that this is a chastisement that comes upon the people of God because they are outside of the promised land. But it will be through Cyrus, the next, another, you know, king and kingdom of Persia that will, which will, you know, exceed over, over Babylon. So, you know, it's just all to say that God uses these individuals and these powers for his purposes. And I really, really don't want, you know, the people of God, as they read through this and they read with an analytical mind or a modern mind, to use that language, whether it's good or not, a modern mind, and say, ah, I can't believe this. This isn't real. This isn't true. You know, making you rule over them all. You know, who's he? He's not. He wasn't doing that. There were peoples all over the world who had their own other rulers. So anyway,
right. Well, and that's why we've been warning against reading it literalistically versus literally. What is the passage trying to tell us? And one of the key aspects to all of this is that this kingdom, you know, all that Nebuchadnezzar has, his kingdom, power, might, glory, all of it has been given to him by God. And that is a key aspect to this, that God set him up. God gave him this kingdom. This isn't Nebuchadnezzar that he's so great and mighty that he's done this for himself. God has given this to him. And that's a key for this passage, is that God set up Babylon. He rules, he is sovereign over all the nations of the world. What are we told in Psalms? That the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord.
Yeah.
And he turns it whichever way he will. And we need, that's a very important verse to understanding how God has ordained all things.
Yeah.
And it's hard for us to understand how can this be true if all things are ordained and we're not, you know, the question is always, well, I guess you're just a robot, right? We're all just robots because we do. And then we're not robots, and we have a freedom within our will, and yet God is in control of all things. This is what Scripture tells us.
Yeah. Just to interrupt real quick, that verse, before we get into all the other things, God of heaven has given the kingdom, right? And then everything follows. What about the kingdom? All these other things that are a part of the kingdom. But and what's a part of the kingdom? It's the beasts of the field, too. It's the birds of the air, right? Yeah. Well, okay, birds fly through and they really aren't controlled by, you know, no, okay. It's the imagery that everything is under the authority of this particular king. But this was all given by the God of heaven. And, you know, we come to learn that the biggest downfall for Nebuchadnezzar is his pride. He doesn't recognize that. He won't recognize that, and he rebels against that, and that's his downfall. That's why he's humble. That's for a later discussion.
Well, this is, again, you know, the key aspect of God giving the kingdom to Nebuchadnezzar. It's at the beginning, right? And we're going to talk about other kingdoms, other earthly kingdoms. Well, the same is true of them as we go through the statue, as we go through these kingdoms that are going to come. God is giving these kingdoms to whoever is ruling them. You know, Alexander the Great for Greece conquers the world, right?
Yep. Yeah.
That's what we're told. He conquers the world and he weeps because there were no world, you know, he was done. Nothing else in the world to conquer. Now that, again, literally
untrue,
versus literalistic.
Right.
He very literalistically, if you look at how he was kind of turned back in the end, and yet he is considered the guy that conquered the whole world.
Right.
Well, okay. Again, see what that's referring to. But because God gives the kingdom to Nebuchadnezzar, the same can be said about Alexander the Great. Greece is not because of Alexander. It's because God is giving it to him. And I know I skipped a whole kingdom there. But Alexander the Great is far more well-known.
Sure. Yeah, Cyrus kings. The Great.
Yeah, poor Cyrus.
Yeah, but God uses each of these kingdoms for a particular purpose.
Right.
And it's focused on a particular area where he has brought his word, where his people are. Right, where his particular chosen people are. You know, the reason we're not talking about Asia or India, those are modern words for those areas, or, you know, Eastern Asia, which would include now, you know, Korea and Russia. The reason we're not talking about those areas is because that's not where the people of God were. Mm-hmm. Now, does that make us a very kind of Middle Eastern, you know, ancient Near Eastern centered?
Western civilization centered.
Yeah. I mean, that's our background, right? I mean, that's where the birthplace of Judeo-Christian kind of worldview arose from. And that's just where it is.
It's history.
We're
talking about history.
Yeah, it is history, and it's our history as well. It's our spiritual history. It's our, as you put it, Western history. It's the beginning of Western history, right? Western history technically isn't considered until you get to like European history,
Greece is what
yeah, really, but and but you know, but there's a history to where Greece came from too, right?
And exactly.
And, you know, the Mediterranean, which includes North Africa, what's now called North Africa. And goodness, you know, Carthage, which comes, well, anyway, that's now you're getting to the stuff of me listening to the rest is history.
Welcome to PBS.
Yeah. Well, the Carthaginians, you know, come from what's modern day Lebanon. And, you know, they set up, and then you got Hannibal. I was listening to a podcast on Hannibal, setting up things in Spain and, anyway. So that comes later. But you just have this, all of these kingdoms and a huge amount of history in this one dream of Nebuchadnezzar that we get a tiny preview of, right? Now, we won't know who these actual, you know, folk are until mm-hmm. the time comes, until it works itself out, these folk, these empires are. Until we're kind of like looking back on it, but we will know.
Right. It's easier for us because, of course, we're 2,000 years later.
Of course.
2,500 years later.
Yeah.
So it's easier for us. But even as we go through the book of Daniel, because this isn't going to be the only time that these kingdoms are talked about, we're going to get more information mm-hmm. as we go through. But before we get, let's not get ahead of ourselves. So let us run through the kingdoms. So we have Babylon, which is modern day Iraq, but the Babylonian Empire, which was conquered by Medo-Persia, which very quickly Persia kind of ended up dominating the dual kingdom, and so it just became Persia. That's modern day Iran, mm-hmm. and of course, like you said, under Cyrus, this is something we'll get to. This is the handwriting on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
When Daniel's there again, he's very old at this time, and he comes. And then around 330, you have Greece under Alexander the Great. He conquers Persia at the time, would have become the Persian Empire. Mm-hmm. And then Alexander dies young, 33, and his kingdom is divided into four. It's divided into amongst his four generals, two of which kind of dominate. And Rome, around really starts to become an empire really around, I don't know, between 150 or something like that BC. It doesn't technically become the world power until later than that, maybe 100 years later than that. But it's Rome actually has a slow expansion as it goes out, but it's mighty in its expansion. So by the time, and I think we talked about this, I don't know if we talked about this last week, maybe I was talking about Sunday school, that when Rome shows up to Judea with all the legions of soldiers as they're conquering their lands, and they would do this to other lands, where they just kind of show up and they say, this is how it's going to work. Either you're going to become part of the Roman Empire and pay tribute, taxes, mm-hmm. or we're going to slaughter you.
Yeah.
And Israel at the time said, how much are the taxes? and that would happen at a lot of other places too. It wasn't just Israel, but that's how they became part of the Roman Empire, how Judea became part of the Roman Empire. And here Nebuchadnezzar is being given this vision to see this. Let me ask you this. Why is Nebuchadnezzar, why do you think, I mean, we're not given the exact reason, but why is Nebuchadnezzar told all this?
Well, Rob, with that question, I think we'll end it there, and we'll have to come back with an answer at our next episode. You can find us, you know, folks, at reformforum.org. You can check out all the wonderful resources there as well. And do go to reformforum.org to check out the upcoming conference coming up at the end of September and sign up and register for that conference. You'll see, get to see Rob and I there, but also the wonderful folks from Reformed Forum. And if you want to know more about the congregation that Rob and I serve, go to westminsteropc.org. And also, let's see, what else we got going on? Well, next week we have the General Assembly of the OPC, so, you know, life is busy. Let's see. Well, next time I think we're going to be doing, I don't want to answer for you, but Daniel?
Well, yeah, you have to answer my question.
Oh, that's right. All right. Well, once again, thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.